You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, November 24th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone, and to everyone, happy Thanksgiving. Today, for you, we have hours 6 and 7 and 8 of the 12-hour marathon show we did last week, just one short week ago from today. Of course, I am not live because it is Thanksgiving Day. In fact, I am sure now, as you listen to this, I'm sitting around a warm hearth with my family around the Thanksgiving table. I'm here at Grandpa's house, and Mila, my six-year-old sweetie, you've had enough dessert. You've had enough. Because you can't have that many pieces of cake. So just put it down. What? So I can have dessert, Nikki. Because I'm an adult, I can have that much dessert. Well, I'm going on a diet Monday, all right? On Monday. Because, of course, I'm going to want to eat the leftovers. And that's what you do on Friday. That's what you do on Saturday. That's what you do on Sunday. Yes, on Monday, diet. 1,600 calories a day, say maybe 1,800. Whatever, doesn't matter. I'm fine. My pants are not that tight. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you're enjoying your Thanksgiving meal. And in case you're not, or you want to block out your family, well, in fact, we have a new podcast for you. Never been on podcast, this information. This great material. And what is it today? Well, we're speaking to Jesse LaGreca. He is Ministry of Truth on Daily Kos, but he's also that guy. You may have seen the video wearing the union cap. Fox News early on in Occupy Wall Street interviewed him, hoping to get like some crazy lunatic who doesn't know anything about anything. And he made them look like fools. And we would have never seen this, of course, from Fox, but somebody else videotaped it. And the Fox reporter looked like an idiot. And it's because Jesse is one of the most eloquent and informed people about the issues surrounding Occupy Wall Street or anything going on in politics, frankly, that I've spoken to that doesn't have my job. And it's probably just a matter of time until he does. But until that time, no, he's on my podcast. I'm not on his. And also joining me today, Glenn Greenwald. The great Glenn Greenwald spoke to me for about a half an hour about Occupy Wall Street and about his new book, And Justice for Some. And the themes are perfectly timed, certainly, when Mayor Bloomberg, His Highness, ignored that little tiny court order. But I'll let Glenn Greenwald talk to you about that. And that, of course, is our free podcast for today. But, wait a second. That's not all. If you are a member of the Majority Report, which you can join right now at majority.fm, though I probably won't send you your information until tomorrow morning. I'm assuming I'm in the middle of an argument at Thanksgiving. You'll not only hear Jesse LaGreca, but you'll also hear Ryan Rizzo. He's one of the publishers of Occupy Wall Street. Very interesting guy, smart fellow. You'll enjoy it. In fact, the original Dorsey calls into the show to say hello. Ian, our man from Occupy Baltimore, who was part of the mic check of Karl Rove. You got to hear that. You're going to really enjoy that. And, of course, Jeremy Scahill, the great reporter from The Nation magazine, Democracy Now!, other outlets. And Glenn Greenwald, like I mentioned. And Harry Siegel, the great independent reporter who's been covering Occupy Wall Street. And then I have a fairly fun interview with Lee Doran, a YouTube libertarian who, nice fellow, very well behaved, and seemingly fairly intelligent. The only problem he had is that he was arguing in favor of libertarianism. And you know how that goes, folks. That's a loser. So there's nothing you can do if you're Lee Doran when you're arguing for libertarianism, unless you guys are listening to the podcast and you're extremely high. So, folks, enjoy these 3 hours of podcast if you're a paid Majority Report member, because you support the show. When I do that 12-hour marathon, I did it for you. I sort of did it for the freebies, but not really. I really did it for you. So enjoy, folks. I hope your Thanksgiving was wonderful, and we'll have another podcast for you tomorrow. Don't eat too much dessert. Save some for me. Talk to you later.
Cities and towns through the ups and the downs, like that New York postal girl's draws. Corporations are people. Corporations are people. Corporations are
this message brought to you by People for Corporate Personhood, a thinking, feeling, limited liability partnership.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. That, of course, was the screaming majority. And on the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program. I'm sure you've seen the video. He and hopefully by now people know him by his name, not the fact that he was wearing that union cap, handing it to Fox. Jesse LaGreca, you may have seen his. What is your handle on Daily Kos?
It's Ministry of Truth.
Ministry of Truth. And, of course, he is also going through security right now as we speak in Chicago Airport. Are you traveling to – have you been traveling around to different Occupies?
Yeah, you know, I did a big road trip about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I was in Wisconsin, Seattle, Denver, Chicago, D.C., Oakland, and then I've been in the city the last few days, and I just came out to Chicago today because I was invited by the Rosie O'Donnell Show to appear. So that's going to be airing tomorrow on the OWN network, the Oprah network. So, yeah, life has been interesting for me. But, you know, the big part is that we're trying to get this message out there that so many people are hurting right now, and we all want answers about our future and what type of country we're going to be. And it's important, you know, so I'm glad to be able to have that conversation with you and Sam, or I'm sorry, with you or with Rosie or whoever wants this honest conversation.
What was it like going on the Rosie show? I mean, she's pretty sympathetic, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. She actually came down to Occupy about 2 weeks ago before we got cleared out and got to experience the community that we're building, started to have some of these conversations. She is very sympathetic. You know, I think she comes from a background that you and I come from, that, you know, 99% of us come from, that we have to work our way through. And, you know, when we talk about the American dream, we have to remind ourselves, no one wants a handout. We all expected to work hard, and we all expected to have something to show for it. And now what we're seeing is that they want us to work hard and get nothing for it. No retirement, work until you die, or work until you, you know, if you can find it, until you die. No education, no health care. You know, everybody fend for yourself. You know, even the cavemen knew that that wasn't going to work. That's why they started a society. So we need to, you know, not be cavemen and be enlightened about the way that we want our country to look in the future.
Right. We should at least land somewhere in between. Let me talk to you, because you've been down the Liberty Square from, as far as I can tell, pretty close to day one, if not day one. What do you think the implications of the eviction are going to be for the movement? Do you think it's going to how do you think it's going to shape the next 5-6 months?
Well, we're in phase two right now, and I told someone the other day, you can't kill an idea. You can't evict an idea. So if anything, you know, on a certain level, I almost am looking at this like a silver lining in the cloud that, you know, now we can take the focus off of the tents. The tents are becoming too much of a focus. The focus should be this conversation about the way corporations buy our politicians, about how we coddle the rich, as Warren Buffett said, and how guys like Warren Buffett, frankly, have too much influence in this conversation. You know, when I hear Buffett or Soros or David Koch or Michael Bloomberg opine on how this economy should work and how our democracy works, they're just one guy. All of their money should not equal speech. It should be one man, one vote, not $1, as many votes as you can purchase. So, you know, if we want a democracy, then we can't have an auction system like we have now. If we want a functioning economy, we need an economy that functions for everybody, not just the richest guy in the room, and if he gets all the money, it'll trickle down. We know that's nonsense. So to me, I think this is a something that we can use to our advantage. You know, take the focus off the tents, make the focus on the events. That's the big thing to me.
What's the biggest challenge to getting more people involved in the movement? I mean, it seems to me, as far back as early February or March of this year, you know, you had that David DeGraw on talking about if you measured how many people are on food stamps within, you know, a 20-mile radius of Wall Street, you'd have 1 million people down there. How is it that you will reach, you think, or how will the movement reach people who are underwater in their mortgages, people who are on food stamps or have lost the food stamps or have lost their unemployment checks? I mean, because, you know, one of the things that I think keeps cropping up for me is that these people are very isolated. They are blaming themselves. And it's one thing to say, I've made a mistake. It's another thing to say, I should pay for that mistake with the rest of my life. And without seeing that if there's something systemically wrong. How do you reach those people?
Well, I think a lot of it is just building a community, which is what we're all doing in a certain sense. It's not just a movement. It's a community of neighbors, of family, of like-minded individuals. So I think one step that we can take is literally going back to our communities, going back to our families. You got Thanksgiving coming up. Talk to the people in your family about what you're witnessing. Suggest to them honest news sources such as this one, such as others that they can find. You know, the internet's got a ton of information if you're looking for it. I think the easiest way to reach people is to make that attempt to reach people. Instead of, you know, what we see in the news, one guy is a partisan screaming at another guy who's a partisan. Let's talk to our neighbors on a level that we can all understand about our future, about what's hurting them. The reality is millions of Americans are hurting. We're all being told that we have to make a sacrifice for a disaster that we didn't create. Now, at the same time, we'll bail out banks, but we won't bail out students. You know, we'll bail out mortgage companies, but we'll let the people with the mortgage just get stuck, like Mitt Romney said, you know, oh, just let it collapse and that'll fix it. Sure, whatever. Nonsense. So I think part of it is honest media outlets like yourself having this honest conversation we all want to have. I think another part of it is that it's our job as participants in this movement to reach out to our neighbors, to talk to our friends, to let them know like what we're really working for is a viable future for everybody and accountability for the people who broke the law, whether they're corrupt politicians or corrupt businessmen. And the more that we talk about it, the more it becomes viral. And I joke because myself, I've got a little experience with viral, but a virus evolves. So this movement is evolving as well. And, you know, it's been in its infancy for the first 2 months. Now we're going to, you know, I guess put on our big boy pants and start doing some serious talking because there's a lot of talk about it, you know?
You know, I'm curious about your perspective on the president because, you know, in that the Fox video, and I'm referring, and maybe I should just back up for a second. Very early on, Fox was interviewing you down in the park with the hopes that you would say something that they could mock. And they didn't end up using any of that video, did they?
No, not one bit. I think what Fox News wants is to create a narrative where a bunch of dirty blanking hippies and we're commies and this and the other thing, and it's just the opposite of the truth. We get a lot of guys who are professionals in this camp. We got a lot of people who are passionate. So, you know, I think both parties want to make this about blame the other guy, and I think Occupy Wall Street is in its own sense an indictment of both parties. The one party that filibusters on behalf of the wealthiest 1% and prevents any sort of reform taking place, and the other party that consistently caves to the Republicans. I'm talking about the Democrats here. And those guys – have not done the job that we sent them to office to do. They find every excuse in the book not to do the right thing, whether it's taxing the rich or passing a public option for health care reform or even just basic reforms. So, you know what? I think Fox News obviously has a narrative to sell. They are obviously the propaganda arm of the Republican Party. I've got my own legitimate criticisms about Obama, but if they want me to say something about him being like Hitler or having no birth certificate, then they look to the wrong guy, you know?
Right. And let's talk about that just from an electoral standpoint. I mean, do you think that there is value in Occupy Wall Street becoming a movement about elections? Or is that something that's best up for individuals to decide upon their own based upon what Occupy Wall Street sort of reflects back on society or teaches us about what's going on in our politics?
Personally, I think every single American should occupy a voting booth. I think everybody should be registered to vote. They should know where their voting locations are. I think that let's look at it like this. I'm not going to tell anybody who to vote for, one party or the other. If you ask me my own personal opinions, I'm more than glad to tell you. I kind of don't even know who I'm voting for on a lot of these elections because, to be honest, neither party is really doing anything to help, whether they're caving for the wealthiest 1% or filibustering on their behalf. But let's look like this. If we could just increase voter participation in this country from below the 50 percentage line to 60 or 70% or even 80 or 90 or 100%, I think we would end up with a government that's much more reflective of their constituents' needs. Every time we vote, we make all that corporate money poured into the system a little bit less potent. So I think, regardless of what policies we're going to support, I don't think it should be our business to support candidates, but that's not for me to decide. I'm just one voice among many. But I think we should all be voters. And I think if we're going to make a major change, and we need to use all the power that we have, whether it's power of the people on the streets or power of people in the voting booth.
Of the occupies you've seen, I mean, what has there been any moments that have stood out for you? Has there been any cities that have stood out for you? Any stories that really resonate with you? I mean, because I mean, I think you have a very unique perspective in terms of having been able to see this movement, both sort of from. Well, I guess you're flying now at 30,000 feet in the air, but also down on the ground in these various cities.
You know, I met a woman in Seattle who had been injured through a medical procedure. She was injured and paralyzed. And because her medical costs had gone through the roof, she can't keep her home anymore. And this woman had tears in her eyes. And her husband was a clergyman. And if you can look at that person and tell them that it's their fault, then you don't have a heart, you know? So that really touched me a lot. I met another gentleman in Seattle whose name is Doc. Doc, if you're listening, I love you, brother. And he was a war vet who came back, and he witnessed what happened in 1999 during the World Trade Organization protests. And he is back again now. And he told me he's worried about us kids, man. He's worried about our generation, that they're doing the same thing all over again. You know, when I was in Oakland, I was there 2 or 3 days after Mayor Kwan, basically face-planted her political career and let the police, tear gas and rubber bullet the crowd. And they were frustrated, but at the same time emboldened, that they feel like, it's obvious when they're shooting tear gas at us that what we're doing is right, and it's really important that we don't go. So, I tell people our problems aren't going away tomorrow. Neither should we. Our problems aren't going away 6 months from now. Neither should we. We need to be the stick that opposes the carrots of corporate donations to our politics. And by stick, I mean simply that. Stick around.
Can you step back?
Certainly, certainly. Stick around. Be involved. Communicate to your neighbors. If you care about this country and our future, then you stand with us. If you're worried about what's going to happen to your family, then you're with us. We're fighting for your future, man. And we're not even fighting. We're just there bearing witness. And for all of our troubles, what do they crack our heads in with nightsticks? The cameras come in during the daytime. They say, what's your message? Then the police come at night and beat us up. And then the cameras come back again and pretend like it never happened. It's like, well, what's your message? We don't get your message. The message is obvious. It's what Dr. Cornel West said. We want a transfer of power from the wealthy oligarchy to the ordinary citizens. And there is no 15-second soundbite that can encapsulate everything we're fighting for, but we're fighting for everything. And to be honest, look at the alternative. If Occupy Wall Street falls apart, who's there to defend the middle class? It's not the Republican Party. It hardly looks like the Democratic Party. We need to apply pressure to these guys to make them more responsive to the citizens' needs and less, totally owned by the corporate needs. Because at the end of the day, it's not the United States of corporate America. It's the United States of America. What's good for Bank of America is not good for the rest of us. And you know what? We need to be that. We need to be that front line that stands in between corporate power and democracy, because the reality is, you know, that our future is very much at stake here.
Now, I know you got to get going because you got this flight, but let me just ask you lastly, tell me what it's meant to you personally. I mean, you've been writing on Daily Kos for years. But it's a different thing. I'm just curious as to what this has meant to you sort of personally. Do you see politics differently in some way? Has it changed your perspective in some way? What are the implications from your direct experience?
To me, it's very personal. You know, all politics are personal, and it has changed my opinion in certain ways. You know, I'm extremely distraught that Democratic mayors are allowing this police violence to take place. To me, it says a lot about how spineless they really are in the Democratic Party often enough. At the same time, you know, my brother is starting a small business. He can't get a loan. He's buried under under debt. My mother had a stroke a couple years ago. She's on a fixed income. Her health care costs are going up. Her rent is going through the roof. The rent is too damn high for my mother, and she's on a fixed income. My sister lost her job, then lost her apartment, then crashed her car. Now it's like the song. You can't get a car, can't get a job. So this affects my family personally. And to be honest, if it means that David Koch has to have his tax cut so badly that my whole family has to suffer for it, that all my friends have to suffer for it. My best friend is an EMT now. He makes $12 an hour, and he saves people's lives. Why are all the EMTs in America not worth as much as one hedge fund manager? Why is that one hedge fund manager pay lower taxes than all the EMTs in the country combined? I think it's very personal, and it makes me say that, you know, the people who oppose Occupy Wall Street, a lot of them have an agenda. They would rather talk about anything else than this honest conversation about our future and the role that corporations and political bribery are taking in our country. At the same time, the people who would say, oh, well, if you just vote for Democrats, we promise to do the right thing in the future. You know, we've seen these guys cave so many times, I have a hard time looking at them with a straight face anymore. So to me, you know, if you want our political support, then get out there and do the right thing for us. Do the right thing for us. Hold these crooks accountable on Wall Street, get the money out of politics, and then we'll vote for you. But I'm not doing it the other way around, because I've had too many broken promises and I don't have patience for it. To me, this is about our future, man. And even if you do vote Republican, you know, we're still fighting for you, man. Even if you do vote Democrat, we're fighting for you. This is about all of us, not the wealthiest 1%, not the people who want to use political power and partisan agendas to just, you know, further their own political careers. I take it very personally, because it's something that's hurting a lot of people I care about, you know?
Jesse LaGreca, Ministry of Truth on Daily Kos. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Sam. I'm a big admirer of your work, man. Keep it up.
It's mutual. I appreciate it. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. We are now in the middle of our seventh hour of our 12-hour program today to celebrate the one-year anniversary of the relaunch, the two-month anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, with coverage of the direct action that's taking place today. I'm just watching video of clergy marching with a sign that says "We are the 99%." Marching down towards Foley Square, a reported at least 10,000 people. This is by an NBC helicopter. I'm seeing them now all being cordoned off by kettling nets, and we'll give an update on that soon. But what better time to bring on the great Glenn Greenwald, author of his latest With Liberty and Justice for Some. And apparently he's got this crazy thesis that the rules and the laws don't apply on the elite to the elite in this country. Glenn, where did you get this crazy idea?
You know, I don't know, Sam. I'm pretty insane. I acknowledge that. And it just sort of came to me in a drunken vision. And that's the only way I can explain it.
What did you do? Did you pay off a Michael Bloomberg to pull this contempt of court the other day just to juice your sales?
The funny thing about that is that the last time I wrote a book, it was in 2008, and I wrote it about the Republican Party and all the reasons it was so awful, and we scheduled it to be released after the Democratic primary was over and everybody was focused on hating the Republicans. And I had the worst possible luck because that was when the Clinton-Obama war went on forever, and by the time my book was released, it was at its apex, and nobody cared at all about Republicans. They only cared about destroying one another. And so this was actually the opposite case in terms of luck, because I wrote this book about the two-tier justice system and about how elites can engage in pure criminality and ignore the law with total impunity, while the ordinary Americans are subject to really harsh and merciless punishment, even for trivial transgressions. And it came out not only as the Occupy movement, which I think is really about that grievance more than it is anything else, was flourishing, but as you just noted, sort of a prime example of that thesis, which is Michael Bloomberg simply ignoring literally a court order that was in place for 9 hours, ordering him to reopen the park and allow protesters back in with their tents. He simply ignored it and kept them out in direct violation of the law, the kind of thing for which ordinary people would be held in contempt of court.
I mean, we've seen both on sort of like a micro level with Occupy Wall Street, whether it's the idea of sort of, you know, a police officer using pepper spray completely against the, I think from what I can tell, even the New York City Police Department rules of engagement, willy-nilly, which would land you in jail. From, like you say, the broader issues where we're looking at this financial crisis, we see ongoing mortgage fraud. And there doesn't seem to be any attempts to enforce the laws about these things.
You know, here's the issue for me, which is, you know, obviously over the last decade, we've seen the world's most powerful economic and political factions commit not just crimes, but the most egregious crimes that exist, from establishing a worldwide torture regime, spying on Americans without the warrants required by law, multiple acts of obstruction of justice by the Attorney General and others. And then private sector crimes like illegal spying as well, the systemic fraud that precipitated the financial crisis. None of this, not a single one of those crimes, has been the subject even of criminal investigations, let alone prosecutions. And if this extraordinary leniency were applied across the board, then you could have an argument that at least the rule of law is being affirmed, and then debate whether leniency is a good approach to criminal justice. The problem is that exactly at the same time that this extreme lawbreaking license has been vested, the very same people who have vested it unto themselves have imposed one of the world's harshest and its largest penal states on ordinary Americans. So we imprison more of our citizens than every country by far, for more trivial transgressions than any Western country, for longer periods of time and with less opportunity for release. And it's this extraordinarily disparate treatment based on status, prestige, and power that is the true offense to the rule of law.
And in your book, you cite that this has been sort of an ongoing developing process. I mean, you cite essentially the pardon of Nixon as sort of the beginning of this. I mean, is that fair to say, at least in terms of like the milestones that this country has seen in that regard?
Well, here's the issue. I mean, obviously, ever since the founding, the country has violently breached the principle that we're all equal before the law. You could almost say that the country is one big oozing tribute to the idea that this principle can and will be violated. That's obvious. But the difference was that even when it was being violated, the principle was rigorously affirmed. So you can look at the founders who owned slaves, and they were writing ringing endorsements to the idea that we're all equal before the bar of justice, that justice is blind, that we're equal before the rule of law. And by affirming this principle, it sort of provided us with the aspirational guidance to understand how we considered progress, what we considered to be perfecting the union. And most of the episodes of progress over the next two centuries were animated by this idea that we're all equal before the law. And when we weren't, that was considered an aberration or a violation that needed correction. What the Ford pardon of Nixon really did was it, for the first time, entailed leading figures in the country, beginning with Gerald Ford, going on television and media figures who supported him, basically making explicit arguments against the rule of law, rejecting this principle, and arguing that if you're sufficiently powerful and important, that it's not just in your interest, but the interest of the entire nation for the rule of law to be suspended when you get caught committing crimes. That was the argument made on behalf of Nixon, that it would be better for the country to heal and move forward and not look into the past. And that was the mentality that then got normalized and has been invoked every single time since then. The political class wants to immunize its own leaders and now private sector actors as well.
I mean, I can see that theme in the context of Bush v. Gore, even this notion that, there are certain things, there are certain instances that are just too big to fail. And so if corners are cut somewhere and, there was such stun as shock that the Supreme Court addressed that there was seemed to be just sort of the sense of like, we can't really hold them accountable. They're beyond it. I guess we can obviously see this in Iran-Contra. And so it's basically what you're talking about is that we're not even pretending anymore. And so that we don't even have a bar in which to measure this stuff.
Right, exactly. I mean, one of the problems, you know, it's interesting as someone who worked for a long time on civil liberties and now writes about it and talks about it, one of the concepts to try and persuade people about why they should care about civil liberties that's difficult to convey, but that what you just said really underscores and all of this really highlights is that typically the way the government will try and abuse its power in the first instance is it'll pick somebody who's hated and marginalized in order to abridge their rights so that nobody cares and people even passively acquiesce. So if the government wants to abridge free speech rights, they'll pick Fred Phelps or a neo-Nazi. If they want to eliminate habeas corpus rights, they'll pick someone with a really Muslimy name and from a really Muslimy country who looks really Muslimish and insist they're a terrorist. That way people think, you know what, in this particular case, I can live with this idea. And the problem is that once you accept that idea, it becomes normalized and institutionalized and is always applied well beyond the original instance that justified it in the first place. And that's how I look at the Ford pardon of Nixon or even Bush v. Gore, which is you can find rational, well-intentioned people who will say, you know what, I remember the Nixon pardon and it really did need the country did need to move on. It was time to put that to the side and let the country heal. And whether you think that's true in that individual case or not, the problem is that once you accept the principle that the rule of law can and should be suspended when powerful people are going to be prosecuted and the country would be too divided, you're essentially ensuring that the next time a politically powerful person breaks the law, they too can invoke that principle and it will be accepted. And the problem with that is that once you remove the sanction of punishment from the law just becomes a suggestion. It becomes optional and people know they don't need to abide by it. And that's why we have such rampant criminality and corruption in our elite class, because they know that this is the mentality that prevails.
That was the thing that was so, I think, offensive about, for instance, like the U memo and everything that happened in the torture regime. You know, the idea, coming to the country and saying, you know, ticking time bomb. Well, my sense was, or even the idea of assassination undertaken by President Obama, because this unilateral assassination, we should say, of an American citizen. The idea, I think, you know, if we were told in the 60s or the 50s that, you're naive, or even the 70s, you're naive to believe that our government doesn't do this. At least there was a sense that it was breaking the law, and that there was this sense that if you could prove it, there would be some accountability. But it's like seems to me there has been this sort of natural progression that has been sort of just squeezing out that line and making it blurry to allow for this like a slippery slope. And I think your dog obviously agrees with me.
Well, my dogs have been very excited all day about the various anniversaries you're celebrating, and I asked them to be quiet, but they were apparently incapable of restraining their excitement, which I understand because I barely am able to restrain myself as well. But what you said is exactly right. You know, every time one of these things happens and things get pushed a little bit further, then we become desensitized to it. I mean, if you remember back in the Bush years, I know that for me personally, one of the things that motivated me to stop practicing law and to start writing and to really believe that there was this sort of growing radicalism was the argument that was made by the Bush administration that they had the power to detain an American citizen on U.S. soil and imprison them without charges of any kind, just simply on the president's say-so. That's what they did to Jose Padilla, who was arrested at Chicago International Airport. And the reason that was so, you know, such a shock to me, honestly, was because it wasn't that I was naive and didn't think the government was capable of such things. I thought that if the government did it out in the open and made explicit arguments that they had the right to do it, that it would at least promote a backlash. Because what do we learn as children about what distinguishes America other than the fact that the government can't imprison you without presenting evidence, putting you on trial, and convicting you beyond a reasonable doubt? And once that got accepted, now we're in the situation where it's not just that the president can detain American citizens without charges. Now he can target you for assassination by the CIA far away from any battlefield. And now that, too, is a power exercise with no transparency, no due process, no checks of any kind. And we seem to have accepted that as well. And this is how lawlessness, you know, essentially manifests, is it goes one step at a time. It's not some overnight you wake up and you move from democracy to tyranny. It's a creeping lawlessness. And we've allowed our political leaders and people with power to operate without constraints. And that is the inevitable outcome.
Do you think, tell me the relationship between this breakdown in the rule of law and the accountability for some and the sort of the economic plutocracy that has happened. I mean, I imagine these go part and parcel. My question is do they emanate from the same sense of proprietariness, I guess, that this is like at the end of the day, this is our society, not the rest of these people. They're there to work the fields occasionally go to war for us. But at the end of the day, it's our society. And so we break the rules. I mean, what's the dynamic between, because it seems, you know, maybe it's just coincidence, but you talk about Ford pardoning Nixon being the sort of that centerpiece of when we headed down this road. And I think you could track almost the exact same time period as when we sort of have slid into a plutocracy of sorts.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated issue, but you know, you're right that what happened was that this idea of immunity was extended first to political officials. So you can trace it from the Ford pardon to Iran-Contra, to the Iraqgate scandal of the Bush 41 administration, and then to the protection of all the criminals of the Bush era. But what then started to happen is this same mentality got applied to private sector elites as well when they started breaking the law. And I think there's two principal reasons why it extended and seeped in and infected that realm as well. One is that the public sector and the private sector have become increasingly commingled, so that more and more government functions are now privatized. So if you look, for example, at the national security state or the surveillance state or the military industrial complex, which Dwight Eisenhower called it, you know, 50 years ago, what you see is more and more functions that have traditionally been performed by the government now being outsourced to private corporations, which work hand in hand with the government. So it's no longer the case that you have a public sector over here and a private sector over here. Therefore, public sector officials have privileges that private sector officials don't have. What they really are, and this is really the right way to think about it, is they're basically nothing more than just two different departments of the same overall entity. And so it wouldn't make sense to allow, for example, NSA officials to spy on Americans without warrants and then immunize them when they get caught, but then allow private sector officials to be prosecuted for doing exactly the same thing because they worked hand in hand and they basically are the same people. I mean, you know, when that happened, when the NSA spied on American citizens, Michael McConnell was at Booz Allen, one of the largest defense contractors in the world and representing a huge amount of telecoms. Later on, he became Bush's director of national intelligence and advocated for immunity for that very industry that he had just served. And then when he was done getting that immunity, he went back to Booz Allen. So it's really like these are lateral moves within the same entity. So it's only natural that the immunity for public officials would extend to their private sector colleagues and partners. And that's what they call them, our partners in the private sector. The other aspect of it is the underlying rationale of immunity as extended to political officials is that certain people are too instrumental in the functioning of our government so that subjecting them to the rigors and harms of the legal system and criminal prosecution specifically would basically be to harm not just them but all of us. So that argument was made, for example, with Richard Nixon. It was made, you know, for all of the CIA officials who tortured that we can't have people on whom we rely for our national security being second-guessed by the courts, meaning accountable under the law when they break the law. And that argument, that rationale, then simply the natural extension of it was, well, look, we rely on Goldman Sachs and Citigroup, right, as bad as they are and as much as we hate them, for our economic prosperity, and therefore to subject them to criminal prosecution would be to harm ourselves as well. It's the same mindset.
Yeah, it's all too big to fail. You know, when I think about the thematically from your book, the first thing when I heard about it, the first thing that came to mind was just the concept of you steal a little bit, they send you to jail. You steal a lot, they make you king. But I guess theoretically, that's what America was founded upon, the principle that that's not the case.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. You know, we talk about the founders all the time monolithically as though they're just one big group that was in total harmony. And the reality is they disagreed vehemently about all sorts of critical issues. I mean, the debates they had make ours look kind of tame. But there is really one thing and one thing only on which they all really did unanimously agree. And not just agree, but emphasize as the supreme principle. And that is that you only have two choices, as John Adams said. You can be a nation of men or you can be a nation of laws. It's either or. And the reason that they were so eager to emancipate themselves from the king, there were lots of reasons, but one main one was because the king really did have the power to exempt himself from law, to exempt his minions and cronies, and impose law as a coercive tool on everybody else. And that's exactly what they were most fearful of replicating. And so over and over and over again, they talk about how we're going to have all sorts of inequality. You know, some people are going to be really rich and most people are going to be poor. Some people are going to be smart and powerful. Other people are going to be, you know, mediocre and powerless. But all of those inequities are legitimate and justified only on one condition, and that is that we're all playing by the same set of rules. Because if not, then those inequities are the byproduct of cheating and not merit or legitimacy. And this is the principle that over and over and over got emphasized by them that eventually got codified in the 14th Amendment when we corrected our most grievous error and sin, which was slavery, that we're all equal before the law, equal protection under the law is guaranteed. And so to repudiate that principle is really to unravel the entire concept. It really is to basically reinvent ourselves as a nation that lives according to the arbitrary whim of rulers who are unconstrained by law, and that everybody else are bound by rules to which they and they alone are not subject. And you can't really do anything more consequential than that.
You know, earlier today, I was speaking to Fran Lebowitz, and she was talking about other values that we've jettisoned. But she said, you know, it's really, really hard to get these values back. Where do we go from here? I mean, I don't see any indication. I mean, I was just stunned by how little reporting I saw about the fact that Bloomberg completely ignored a court order. I mean, there just seemed to be absolutely no outrage and no surprise about it in any of the vast majority of the media outlets. I see no indication that there's anything happening in society to make this change. What happens next?
You know, I'm sure you had the same experience, but I know that ever since I began writing about politics, I would go around to different venues and writing and interviews and speaking and the like, and talk about systemic problems in our political culture. And the question always was, well, what can be done about it? What can we do about these things? It seems also, you know, daunting, these problems. And one of the reasons why I love Occupy Wall Street and the Occupy movement so much, and is a sort of selfish reason almost, which is it provides an answer to that question. I mean, you can point to something tangible because, you know, in my view, and this has been a little bit difficult to sort out, but, and it's hard to talk about what motivates Occupy, the Occupy movement, because there's so many disparate groups and factions and drives and the like. But I really do believe that that you could never have a sustained protest movement in the United States based solely upon anger over inequality unto itself, because we've been inculcated for so long to believe, like the founders believed, that inequality and wealth and income and everything else is not just inevitable but desirable. And so, like, when someone like Steve Jobs dies with $8 billion, very few people begrudge that, even while we have extreme joblessness and homelessness and foreclosures, because there's a sense, for right or wrong, that $8 billion was earned, that he deserved it, that he invented technologies and inventions and played by the rules and got what he got because he deserved it. If it were just inequality, you wouldn't have a protest movement. We've had massive inequality for 3 decades. It's been growing for 3 decades. That hasn't changed. What has changed is the perception that the reason that people are winning isn't because they're winning because they deserve it or because it's merited or because they played by the same rules as everybody else. The perception is that they're winning because they cheated, because these are ill-gotten gains. The winners are basically winning illegitimately. And that has created the perception, accurate, I think, that our political and legal institutions are so fundamentally corrupted that no meaningful change can be effectuated within them. And the only viable course of option is like what the Arabs had to do as part of the Arab Spring, which is bind together as citizens upon our common grievances and essentially signal to the elite class, the ruling class, that the status quo is unacceptable and intolerable and that it won't be tolerated or accepted any longer. And I do think that's the only viable alternative. And I think putting fear into the hearts of those in power is the absolute key prerequisite to improving any of these things. And I think this unrest and disruption that you're seeing in the very incipient stages is devoted to that, and that's why I look upon it so favorably.
Glenn Greenwald, author of With Liberty and Justice for Some, thanks for so much for joining us. Of course, you can be read every day or just about every day on Salon.com. Thanks so much for coming on, and I've enjoyed your work for years, and hope to talk to you again soon in the future. And
congratulations on your anniversary.
Please.
Yeah, they're saying congratulations as well.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you, dogs. And please, sounds like they need to be walked, for God's sakes.
All right, Sam.
All right. Thanks, Glenn.
Say it's an apple pay.